You're listening to the ESPN Footy Podcast.
G'day guys, welcome to Red Time for another week. I'm Jared Barker and Jake Michaels is not with me, but joining me. We are recording this week's episode on Zoom. You're up in Queensland for the swimming champs at the moment. How are things up north?
Things are good. The weather is a bit hit and miss. It's been raining this morning and then sunny again. So why does everyone always say it's only like that in Melbourne? It's like that everywhere, right? 1 minute it rains, 1 minute it's dry. But yeah. This does take me back to the COVID days, right? I haven't done a Zoom pod recording quite a while. So did not miss the technical difficulties for the hour leading into the record, I must say.
Which we have absolutely had, but we'll crack on, mate. Exciting slate of games for us this weekend and genuine 50-50 contest everywhere you look. We're going to start with the Master versus the Apprentice, though, Jake. Does Sam Mitchell deserve to be under more pressure than Alistair Clarkson ahead of this week's game between North and Hawthorn?
Does Sam Mitchell deserve to be under more pressure than Alistair Clarkson? No, I really don't think he does. Look, Alistair Clarkson is 3-15 at North Melbourne since joining at the start of last year. Obviously, he missed a chunk of games last season. But six of those 15 losses have been by 50-plus points. Mitchell's 15-35 at his time at the Hawks. So by no means does he have a sparkling record with Hawthorn in his time. But there have been signs that have suggested that the Hawks are on the right track. We look back last year. They had two massive wins over Brisbane and Collingwood, the two grand finalists. It was just they couldn't sustain it. And it was an up week, a down week, and that sort of roller coaster ride. But I haven't seen any of that from North Melbourne. I haven't seen the peaks from North that suggest that they are on the right track. Whether that's under Alistair Clarkson or whichever coach, there's been nothing to suggest that they are on the right track to be able to turn this club around. And now everyone wants to tell me that North Melbourne has the far better list, which seems to be a story that's come out last week. Everyone comparing North and Hawthorn's list. So if North Melbourne has the far superior list, why wouldn't Alistair Clarkson, who everyone believes is a better coach than Sam Mitchell, be under more pressure to deliver?
Well, I think it's because his name's Alistair Clarkson, right? And you said it. I mean, he's achieved so much and he won the four flags with Hawthorn. No matter what happens with North and his time there, no one's going to remember Alistair Clarkson because of what he achieved at North Melbourne. It's always going to be the four flags at
But is that fair?
Hawthorn.
But is that fair? That's like the Michael
I think
Jordan
with what he's
argument.
Achieved, it probably is.
Yeah, but that's the Michael Jordan argument of the six rings, but taking out the other 9 years of his career. It's like you've got to take the whole... It all counts as part of your legacy. So he's only been there, as I said, it's been 18 games so far that he's coached. So it's not a big enough, it's not a huge sample size. And you do need to give him time. And I'm a skeptic of parts of Alistair Clarkson's coaching. And I need to be slow down and pump the brakes on any kind of criticism. But it's just about the question is who should be under more pressure? I don't think either should necessarily be under the heat big time. But I do disagree that Sam Mitchell has deserved to be under more right now than Alistair Clarkson does.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think the Hawks, their situation probably isn't as bad as it seems, especially when you look at they're already a really young, inexperienced team, but they've copped a few injuries this year as well. When you lose James Blank, CJ, and then Will Day, and Mitch Lewis and Luke Bruce quite recently as well, you take those sort of players out of a good team and they might struggle. Yeah, they can probably cover them because they're probably a better team because they have more depth. But you take that caliber of player out of a bad team and what do we expect? So I don't think the Hawks are in that dire a situation. They've been competitive against a few good teams this year and were probably stiff not to beat Collingwood. If Connor McDonald kicks that goal, they've already got a win in there in the win column. So I think, disappointing against the Suns, but the expectations for Hawthorn this year were probably unrealistic by a lot of people. So I think they'll win this week. I think they'll beat North, and then all the talk, and rightly so, should go back on the ruse and why they're 0-6.
Well, that's the thing. If they don't win this week, it's hard to find one. And how many wins do you think they get for the year? It's hard to find more than sort of three wins for North Melbourne this year.
Is that the line? 2.5?
Oh, 2.5, 3.5. It can't be much more than that. And I tell you, I'd still probably be leaning towards the under. I mean, someone mentioned earlier in the week, will they go winless this year? And I think that's an overreaction because we just don't see that happen, no matter how poor a side is. But it, as I said, it is difficult to find, you know, 3 or 4 wins on the schedule. So, yeah, we'll have to wait and see. Hey, Nathan Murphy, we spoke about him on Tuesday's episode and his retirement. Yeah, it's sad, you know, coming off the back of concussion, and we saw it with Angus Brayshaw only a few months earlier. I guess it begs the question, is it time to stop celebrating courage in football?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I don't think courage in general should ever stop being celebrated. I mean, yeah, nothing garners more respect from your coaches and your teammates than putting your head over the footy and committing an act of courage. But I guess when you do hear the report and you're seeing someone be medically retired, it just adds to all the importance and the new moves the AFL is trying to make to try and alter the way that players are approaching contests. I do wonder now if the language in the game is going to change because of this. Now, Nathan Murphy, when you think of the saying, you know, when it's your turn to go, you got to go. Well, that was Nathan Murphy to a T, just with the way that he played, and he flew himself into packs with no regard for his own safety. But he was sort of that height where he could do that, but he could also go hard at the ground ball as well, which is the sort of contest that he was last involved in with Lincoln McCarthy in the grand final. So while it's always fine to celebrate those sort of acts, and you can go back to the Jonathan Brown and the Nick Riewoldt marks, which everyone knows that they get played over and over simply because they're just such good acts of courage. And I now wonder whether coaches at the junior level, more specifically, caution against their players trying to really emulate those sort of acts. I'm not saying they should necessarily, tell these kids to not go back with a flight. But the reality is your health and well-being is more important than your football career. And that's why Angus Brayshaw and Nathan Murphy have made these calls recently. So I don't think we stop celebrating acts of courage. The reason why we say they're courageous is because we all know they're putting themselves in harm's way. But I just wouldn't be surprised if we see less and less of those acts, knowing what the repercussions are in this day and age. So yeah, maybe we don't stop celebrating acts of courage, but maybe the techniques are going to change.
Yeah, I think you said it best when you mentioned about, you know, Nathan Murphy, and that when it's your time to go, you go. And we've heard that. That's a phrase that we've heard for years in footy. And I think players are maligned for not going when it's their time, or I guess supposed time to go. And so that probably leads to players putting themselves in harm's way because they don't want to be seen as the player that chickened out of a contest, for lack of a better way of putting that. I said on Tuesday, I think that we will see more players retiring because players need to put their health first, as simple as that. You know, it's not a sport where they don't have the luxury of being paid, you know, tens and tens of millions of dollars to play every year. And you need to look after yourself. You need to think about what are we doing for the next chapter of my life, the next chapters of my life. How can I continue to make an income and work and support my family and lifestyle? And I think we will see more players retiring due to concussion and long lasting effects of injury, particularly concussion. And I think it's a good thing to see. We need players to look after themselves. We don't want to have players down the line, 30, 40, 50 years, and lawsuits coming up, and why wasn't it done better? Why was there not more research or thought going to this from the AFL? So I think the shift is good, but obviously it is sad that we do lose players in their primes to these sort of injuries.
Jake, one of the biggest talking points this week as well is, of course, the Charlie Cameron tribunal hearing for his dangerous tackle on Jake Lever last week. It was assessed as a 1-week ban by the MRO, Michael Christian, but he's now free to play. Was the AFL tribunal right to downgrade it to a fine?
No, I don't believe it was. I think Chriso got it right. It was a week. I think quite clearly everyone felt it was a week when it happened. Then it came out that it was a week. And then everyone going into the tribunal hearing sort of said, well, he's not going to get off. It's going to stay a week. So everyone seemed in line throughout this whole process, yet we get to the end of the line and Charlie Cameron's playing. So it doesn't really add up, right? As I said, the sanction was correct. And once again, the AFL's made to look quite hypocritical. This has been an ongoing theme so far this year. We've had, what are we now? We've played six rounds with the opening round. And I feel like there's been four or five incidents like this where you look at someone, an incident, and you think, gee, they need to be rubbed out. They need to be suspended. And it doesn't happen. I mentioned it with Zach Butters last week. I spoke about it with George Hewitt in opening round. I remember punching Lachie Neal. There just seems to be so many incidents where the AFL should come in and stamp it out. And in this case, they did. But then they've gone back and now the tribunal's allowing him to play. So I just think it's a really poor look. And we're going into the territory now where nobody knows. And that's the most worrying part. Nobody knows what should be a suspension and nobody knows what shouldn't be a suspension. It feels basically like a lucky dip. And in all honesty, I think the current system needs a complete overhaul.
Yeah, I think it's a weird one because I'm probably okay with him getting off for that specific tackle. I think it was definitely on the lighter side of a dangerous tackle, but he wasn't completely let off. He still got fined. I think they used the words exceptional and compelling circumstances as to why it got downgraded. And that
and what goes into that is exactly? A fact.
Well, he pled guilty. Jake Lever wasn't injured. And he has a good record by not being banned before. He had the character references as well. So they compiled all of that together. Well, I don't think it is. I don't think it should be. No. I mean, him being downgraded is not the issue, but I think you're right. It's the reason why he got off that creates a massive opportunity now for other clubs to go down this path at a tribunal hearing, which is why I'm stunned the AFL didn't appeal the result as well. Like, I'm with you. I'll be utterly shocked if the AFL at the end of this season allows the tribunal to continue using this off-field personal character references for on-field incidents as part of their discretions at a hearing. If that's still going on beyond this season, I'll be pretty shocked. So yeah, to reiterate, I'm fine with him getting off, but not because he's a good bloke. I mean, I couldn't care less what community work he's done. Like, good on you and well done. But if Mother Teresa slings someone to the ground and concusses them, we'll bloody ban her.
Yeah, look, call me a hypocrite, but I don't think that someone's record should come into play when determining the sanction. Unless, of course, you're looking at someone who is a repeat offender in a particular area. Yeah, you know, someone like Kazaia Pickett, who we've spoken about on this podcast. When you're repeatedly doing the same thing, that's when I think the sanction needs to be increased. But if you do something once, you can't then say, well, I've never done it before, so it should be reduced my penalty. I just don't think that adds up.
You're
still offending, exactly, and you still must cop the right penalty. And as you said, we've said it a couple of times, I think the AFL missed the mark once again here. And yeah, something drastic needs to be done because there doesn't seem to be any sign that we are getting close to consistency on what is and isn't a suspension anymore. And that's just frustrating fans. And we're going to get to finals, and you mark these words, and we'll get to finals, and there'll be a debate around whether someone should be suspended for something that some will say that should be 2 weeks, that should be 3 weeks, and then it'll end up getting zero. So it's just a really messy situation at the moment, and something's got to change. Hey, speaking of something that might well change, Anzac Guernseys have become a big thing in the last few years for all clubs, not just the traditional Collingwood and Essendon playing on the day. Do you like it, or do you think it's poor form from the other clubs to sort of cash in on these Guernseys?
Well, I've flipped on this across the last sort of 24 hours while I've been thinking about it, Jake. Adelaide released theirs during the week, and that's been met with some mixed reviews, it must be said. GWS revealed theirs as well. I think if the intention is good, then it's fine. I think that's where I sit right now. I understand completely where people are coming from, saying that it might be insensitive or just wrong for clubs to be profiting out of Anzac Day, because this isn't a day of celebrating. It is a day to remember. I just look at these announcements by clubs as a way that they can commemorate and just do that little extra bit to honour and remember those who sacrificed their lives. Now, is it necessary? Well, no. But again, what's the intention of the Guernsey? So maybe I just try and see the good in things a little bit too much. I don't know. I think the club coming up with those designs, or any club doing that that doesn't play on the day, they should be proud of having one. But let's not forget what the importance of this day is either. So, look, Adelaide have said in their statement that they'll be auctioning off their player-worn Guernseys, and the proceeds raised will be going towards the RSL Anzac Appeal. So, to me, that's a tick. I think where people are coming from, though, is the merchandise sales. A percentage of those will be going towards the appeal as well, I believe. So, knowing that, I do become okay with it. I'll just like to think that we're all old enough and mature enough to sort of understand the wider meaning of this day, and especially designed Guernsey, I don't think changes that, even if it is worn during the round and not just on the day. I think it's play on. The clubs that have found an opportunity to raise money, and I just refuse to look at that as a bad thing.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't get why there's so much or such widespread criticism for it. The only thing I would say, it kind of goes without saying, but and it does piggyback off what you were saying, is that the proceeds need to go to the Anzac Appeal. I think that's quite clear, and most people would feel that way. Now, some clubs have come out and said that their Guernseys, the proceeds from the sale of their Guernseys, a percentage will be going to. Now, the question I have to that is, well, what's the percentage? Is it 2%? Is it 60%? Because that's quite significant, that, you know, what it could be and what it might be. So I think getting an answer around that is probably what you want to get. The fact that they haven't come out and said, you know, 80% of the proceeds or 100% or 50% makes me think it's probably less than it should be, but I don't know the answer to that 100%. But look, you know, everyone loves the Guernseys. We had fun, you know, a couple of weeks ago, had a gather round where we were talking about the different Guernseys. Everyone loves the Indigenous Guernseys. I'm all for having different ones, especially if it means that you can commemorate something and you can raise money for a cause. I don't ever see that as being a bad thing.
No, I think that's well said. Moving on, we're only 5 matches in,
each team.
Well, for every club, you know what I meant.
Yeah.
Was that hard to comprehend, Jake, was it?
Well, kind of. I wasn't really sure.
Well, already early this season, we do have the standout players across the competition. But rather than look at who the standouts have been, we took a different angle on this. We want to look at the other end. So we have those that maybe aren't firing on all cylinders. Mm. And I thought, based on the expectation and what we've seen so far, Jake, who has been the most underwhelming player of the season so far?
Yeah, there's a few candidates. And it's always a little bit more fun looking at that side of things as opposed to the players who are performing well, which everyone raves about and we already know. But I think, look, I had two or three names, and I've narrowed it down to Darcy Parrish. Now, it might sound a little unfair because he's only played 3 games. But
you're a big fan of this guy too.
I have, and I've been a big defender of Parrish since he made the move into the midfield, and everyone was sort of criticising him, saying, hey, no one plays on him, he wins cheap ball. But he's been the number one centre clearance player in the league over the last 3 years. And that, just say that to yourself. The number one centre clearance player in the league over the last 3 years, more than Liberatore, more than Neil, more than Oliver, more than Bontempelli, more than any of these guys. And he does not get talked about like any of them. And I think too often is that overlooked as part of a... It's such a valuable skill. The two things in footy is kick, you got to score, and you got to win the ball in contest. And he can win the ball in contest as well as any player. So I think he gets a massive tick there, and I do think he's underrated. But he has been poor to start this year. As I said, only 3 games, but those clearance numbers have dropped from almost 8 per game to under 4. Disposals from 31 to 23, contested possessions down, inside 50s down. He's not a notable or big goal kicker, but he hasn't kicked a goal yet in those 3 games. And the Bombers really need him, goes without saying. But Zach Merritt needs as much support as he can get in the midfield, with particularly some of the other guys in there and some of the injuries they've got. And they really need Darcy Parrish to step up. And I think the early part of this year, and I'll say it for a third time, yes, it is only three games. He hasn't played the full five. But the signs are there that he doesn't look as confident as he has in the past. And I think Bombers fans will be hoping he can get back to being the player he was over the last few seasons.
Interesting you say Parrish, because that's the name that I wrote down straight away as well. And only three effective kicks per game this year, which I think is just stunning. 36% overall efficiency, which is just well down. He's just another one who, he's not influencing games. And you spoke about how good he's been in the past. Mm. His down form is probably, balanced out by the fact that Zach Merritt is putting together an extraordinary season. I think his start to the season has been really, really strong. But you said it, 21 and 22 touches for Parrish in the last couple of weeks. I just think the Bombers need more from him. And coming back from injury, I do expect he does get better. But he's playing, he's out there, then I think it's fair to judge him the same way. Pull your socks down too, Darcy. Unpopular opinion, but I'm not really a fan of the... of the socks.
Were you listening on Tuesday? Matt was going on about this on Tuesday.
What was he saying? Well, he liked it, doesn't he?
Well, so you clearly weren't listening Tuesday, so thanks for that.
No worries.
No, he was saying that he was noticing players that go from being socks down to socks up and vice versa. And Parrish seems to be one of those guys that's changed, but he needed to go back through the Getty images and make sure that he wasn't just a one-off a game for him where he had the socks up, I believe. But yeah, look, I think they need to get more out of him. He is, as I said, he's a great player, has been for a number of years now in the midfield. And yeah, they're going to need all the help they can get this year, the Bombers, I think. So hopefully for his sake, he can get back to it. And I think he can, it is a small sample size. He has proven over the few years that he can be a top tier midfielder, and I expect him to get back to that. Last week we saw Sam Taylor in a really nasty incident, and obviously not going to play this week against the Blues. Massive loss. But is it the biggest loss the Giants could have? In other words, is Sam Taylor GWS's most important player?
Yeah, I think it's quite easy to say yes, because we know how good he is. You could say Jesse Hogan is as well, given his form, but you could say the book ends
at Hogan. Would you have said that at the start of the year?
Not at the start of the year, but given his form and what he's been able to produce since even last season, he was quite good when fit. I think this weekend might just prove it with Sam Taylor. It's not that big a call because, as I said, every team losing their best key defender, it's never ideal. But if there's one team in the competition you don't want to be playing against without your best key defender, it's Carlton with their twin towers that they've got there. So, look, Jack Buckley's a very good player. Himmelberg offers plenty of height down there as well. Maybe Connor Iden has to play a bit taller. But Sam Taylor has contested 16 defensive one-on-ones this season. He's lost zero of them. So he's undefeated.
He's a freak.
He's great. And from memory last year, I think he missed six games because of a hamstring injury. It's probably the reason why he didn't make the All-Australian team in the end. Now, they lost four of those games, and one of those wins, with all due respect to North fans, was against the Roos. So he's a big loss. We know that. And while it's not clear cut, I guess we'll find out this week and why he is their most important player.
Yeah, I think there's two parts to this. I think... you nailed it. He is the player they could least afford to lose this week against their opposition, Carlton. As you said, the best key forward duo in the league, in my opinion. Just brutal loss to have to go up against Harry Mackay and Charlie Kerner without him. But with that said, is he their most important player for the course of the season? I still would give the nod to Toby Green. I think he is their most important player, not just because of how good he is as a footballer, but the fact he is now captain, he's their leader, he makes everyone else walk taller. I just think he adds so much and gives everyone else so much more belief when he walks out or runs out onto the field with everybody else that they can beat anybody. And obviously, you wouldn't want to lose either of them for a season. But I think if you had to lose one for the rest of this year, not just this game, because I'm with you on this game, it probably is Taylor is the one you want more. But for the rest of the year, I reckon it's green that you can least afford to lose. So yeah, it's very tight, but I'd probably go green by a hair.
He is that unique sort of player as well. He can play as a genuine key forward and floats up into the midfield.
Yeah. He can play out of the square. He can play half forward. He can go into the midfield. Like, he's just such a uniquely brilliant footballer. And, you know, we're still saying this about him. And let's be honest, he's had a, you know, you could have thrown Toby Green's name up aside from, I think he kicked five in gather round against Gold Coast.
Yeah.
He hasn't had a great start to the year for his standards. When you look at expectation, I had him as the number one player in the league coming into the year. So on expectation, he's been down on that, but he's still a superstar player and a guy that, yeah, they would not want to lose for the year. Absolutely.
It's a huge game at Marvel Stadium on Saturday, Jake, and the start of a difficult stretch for the Blues. I'm interested to know your thoughts. As a Blue bagger, what's Carlton's pass mark for the next five games? They've got the Giants this week, then it's Geelong, then Collingwood, then Melbourne, then Sydney. What's their pass mark?
Betson, it's a very tough run, a tough five-game stretch. But pass mark by definition, right? It needs to be better than 500. It needs to be better than even. So you're looking at 3-2. Now, 3-2, I think most Blues fans right now, given the injuries, given the loss last week to the Crows and just sort of brought up a few more concerns and questions, I think most Blues fans would take 3-2 right now over the next 5 weeks. Sign up for that. I know I would. I think 3-2 would be a tick and move on to a softer part of the draw because it doesn't get much tougher than that. As I said, with those injuries, I think Carlton's more likely to go 1-4 over this next five than 4-1. I really do. I could see Carlton going 1-4. You know, this was the period last year. Carlton started well. You know, top four team looked like, Voss has been able to turn them around. They're going to be a really good side. And then they had that period, remember, where it was just 8 or 9 weeks. I think they only won one game against West Coast. And they just fell all the way down into the bottom four, famously with the Giants. And then both were able to jump back up to play finals and go on to playing prelims, which was quite remarkable in itself. But it was this point of the season where they did start to tail off. And I'm just wondering whether... tough loss last week to the Crows, a game they probably look back on and think could have won that, got a little unlucky in that. And as I said, would not be surprised if a 1-4 type record sort of played out over the next 5 weeks. And then if that does happen, you're right back at even basically. So then you're fighting for the eight once again.
Yeah, I think you're right. It has to be 3-2. They're a premiership contender. We know this club has let their fans down for quite some time, but they're a contender now.
You can say that
again. They have the expectation. They've earned that expectation, and they have no choice but to live up to the hype now. I mean, these next five games aren't the be-all and end-all for them, but you know, while there'll still be a long way to go, if you want to back up that hype, you've got to be beating these sort of teams. So, and they should be, to be honest. They should be expecting to. They're the favourites against the Giants. I didn't expect that, but it's not a surprise to see them start favourites. They could start favourites in a lot of these, especially if they do win this week. So they need to be winning most of these. There's no excuses for the Blues now. And you're right, three wins minimum. And if they win more than that, well, they're probably the team to beat.
If they're 2-3 or, God forbid, 1-4, now let's just stay 2-3. If they're 2-3, will it change?
A winning record.
No, but if they're 2-3, will it change what you think of them? Obviously, it depends how the games go and who they lose to and all that. But would you look at them in 5 weeks if they went 2-3 and say, I don't know if this side can actually do damage in September?
No, but you're right. It depends on how they lose and the circumstances behind all of those games. So the reality is what's the easiest game in there? Maybe Collingwood if they lose to Port this week and lose to the Bombers on Anzac Day, that maybe it's the one that you can pencil in. But if they beat
sounds crazy
the Giants,
to say pencil in the win over the reigning Premier.
I know, but that's if they beat Sydney at the SEG, they beat the Giants this weekend. And then they lose to Collingwood, it becomes a bit weird. And maybe after that, you analyze them a little bit more. But the reality is a winning record's a winning record, and I think the minimum has to be 3-2 for him.
Yep, agreed. Last question. Massive game on Saturday night. I'll be heading along Brisbane, taking on the Cats at the Gabba. I sort of came up with this question because I was looking at both sides and two interesting teams to start the year for very different reasons. And I wanted to throw this one to you. Who is more likely to win the flag out of these two sides?
This is a really weird answer. I think Brisbane is the better team, but my answer is
Geelong. Brisbane.
Well, like, no, what? Geelong. So I need to stay consistent with this. I've explained my theory before, but I've backed Carlton to win the premiership this season. And whenever I make the preseason tip, I do tend to stick with whoever I think the best Victorian-based team is. You need to win the grand final at the MCG. If you finish high enough, you get your finals in Melbourne, you don't travel, home grand final. I think naturally you're just favoured. It's just the way it is. The AFL is a seriously unfair competition, really. But as I've maintained, the Giants are the best team in the comp, but I still said Carlton will win the flag because they're the best Victorian-based team. And so I think I'm more likely. It's the same with Brisbane and Geelong. But in all honesty, I say that, but I'm still not bullish on the Cats. I mean, they've got a really weak midfield relative to the rest of the competition, which is what I worry about with them. It just doesn't scream premiership midfield to me. And yeah, I'll be happy to eat my words if it all eventuates, but I just don't think they're as good as their record suggests either. I mean, they've beaten North, they've beaten Hawthorn. Adelaide at the start of the season was a great time to get them in hindsight. And St Kilda at GMHBA, where they never lose anyway. So they've beaten who they've played, and that's great, but I still think the jury's out on the Cats.
Yeah, I agree. I've said that on the pod. I wrote about that in 6 points a week ago. Need to see it against a good team and need to see it consistently against the good teams before I can buy in on the Cats. My answer is Brisbane. Look, I'm not overly concerned with the 0-3 start. I wasn't really. I was sort of projecting, saying it'll get concerning if they lose 4 or 5. But you can look at the previous years. 2021, they started 1-3. Last year, they started 1-2 and almost won a grand final. So they have been traditionally slow starting sides under Chris Fagan. Now, is that a concern? That's a separate concern, maybe. But they do certainly warm into the season. They've been dominating territory, best inside 50 differential side so far this year. And they've been one of the unluckier teams so far. You know, some people will remember Christian talking about this on a Tuesday a few weeks ago, whereby they have had teams that their opposition has kicked just accurately against them, an unsustainable level of accuracy against Brisbane. So all of that does revert to the mean, and it does mean, you know, all these extra goals that their opposition are getting, they don't get that every week, and they do, that results in more wins for Brisbane. So I think they've been much better than what their record suggests, and I do think they've been better than how Collingwood has gone, despite how that head-to-head game went. So Brisbane would be my answer. Big advantage playing at home. They'll want to get their first win at the Gabba on the ticked off and get that all sorted. And I think then they can settle into the season when they'll be back even side and can get things going again where there's not as much pressure, because the pressure begins to mount with every loss. And once you can get yourself back on track, I think they'll be fine. The big issue or the big loss, I think, was Tom Duda. I don't think people realize how important he was going to be for this side and just how much more he would strengthen up that back line. It's probably the area that you look at as of concern. And obviously Coleman as well, another player that they're not going to see for the rest of the year. So little concern with the back line, but everywhere else getting ticks. And yeah, Brisbane would be the team that's more likely to win it than Geelong right now for me.
If the Cats win this weekend, does your answer change?
I don't want to cop out, but I'll probably take a leaf out of your book and say it'll depend on how the game goes. It'll be a massive scalp. It probably will. I mean, because I do think quite highly of Brisbane, and if Geelong go up there and beat them in Brisbane and hand them another loss at the Gabba, not only do you have to reassess again what you think of the Lions, but you also need to start thinking, okay, maybe the Cats are legitimate. You know, because the teams that they've beaten, we keep brushing them off and saying, well, they're not good. But if they then go and beat a Brisbane side that looks to be back, they've beaten a Bulldogs team during Gather Round without Patrick Dangerfield playing. And the Bulldogs are up and down, but they played pretty well that night. I think we've got to start reassessing Geelong. So, yeah, look, I would say so without knowing how the game plays out.
Fair enough. Good call. We'll leave it there for the week. Thanks for the chat, Jake. And I'll speak to you on the Tuesday pod. Matt's decided he deserves a break. Surprise, surprise. But that's
he's
all
off
right.
For a while, we'll pick up the slack.
He is off for a little while. So it'll be left to us, but that's all right. Thanks to everyone at home for tuning in. Enjoy the footy, and we'll speak to you all next week.
Thanks for joining us on the ESPN Footy Pod. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.